Hello, this is William Fink of Christogenia.org, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, December 4th, 2020. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. Today we are actually pre-recording. Right now it's Friday morning. Melissa and I are with the League of the South in Kentucky. This will be a short trip. It's an annual gathering. It's a Christmas party, but it's really not about Christmas. It's only about fellowship, and this happens to be the time of the year when people are able to take vacation, take time off from work, and seek to engage in fellowship. So here we are. We are going to present our commentary on the Wisdom of Solomon. This is part 16, and it is titled, The Works of Wisdom. From the beginning of Wisdom chapter 9, we have begun to present and discuss Solomon's prayer for wisdom, a prayer which he continues through to the very end of this book. In the final verse of that chapter, addressing Yahweh God himself, while imploring him for wisdom so that he can rule over the people righteously, Solomon had acknowledged that through wisdom, the ways of them which lived on the earth were reformed, and men were taught the things that are pleasing unto thee, and were saved through wisdom. Thus he introduces the theme which begins in this chapter, that by the wisdom which is found in the Word of God, God has preserved and shall continue to preserve his creation, so that his will shall be fulfilled upon the earth. Saying this, Solomon was referring to something which he does not explain explicitly until Wisdom chapter 19, where he wrote in reference to the organization of the children of Israel into a peculiar kingdom under the laws which were given through Moses at Sinai. And he said in Wisdom chapter 19, for the whole creature in his proper kind was fashioned again from above, serving the peculiar commandments that were given unto them, that thy children might be kept without hurt. And I understand that the King James Version has fashioned again anew, which Branton had followed, but the word is anothen, and it literally means from above. We will comment on that passage fully when we get to Wisdom chapter 19 in this commentary. This method of writing, where a conclusion is alluded to but not stated explicitly until he approaches the end of the discourse, is also a feature of Ecclesiastes. That is another aspect of wisdom, which leads me to believe that Solomon was indeed its original author. While the work may have also been translated into Greek by a skilled hand at a later time, we cannot rule that out. Now, as we commence with Wisdom chapter 10, Solomon shall proceed by recounting works of wisdom which are actually the works of the wisdom of God for the benefit of men. Doing this, Solomon continues to portray wisdom as a woman and continues attributing the works of God to her, since earlier in the book he had portrayed her as an aspect of God himself. As we commence, it may also become evident that to Solomon, the works of wisdom are truly the works of Yahweh our God, and men either will learn from them, whereby they are preserved, or reject them and suffer the consequences. Ostensibly, anything which opposes Yahweh's will is folly rather than wisdom. Thus he starts from the beginning, at least as it relates to men, by which we mean to describe the race of Adam. Wisdom chapter 10, verse 1. She preserved the first formed father of the world that was created alone and brought him out of his fall. And here wisdom is, of course, referring to Adam as the first formed father of the world. But that does not mean that Adam was the father of every hominid or beast on the planet, as we have often pointed out in other contexts. In Wisdom chapter 18, Solomon describes what he means by world, where he said, "For in the long garment was the whole world, and in the four rows of the stones was the glory of the fathers graven, and thy majesty," speaking to God, it's still in his prayer, "and thy majesty upon the diadem of his head." If we read the Antiquities of Flavius Josephus, for instance, he explains that the diadem on the head of the high priest had the name of Yahweh inscribed on the front of it, the tetragrammaton. The four rows of gemstones attached to the long garment of the high priest, representing the whole world. Those gemstones stood for the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, and they alone are the world to which Solomon refers. So just like our citation earlier this evening from Wisdom chapter 19, verse 6, Solomon alludes to things and explains them at the end of his work, the same thing that he did in Ecclesiastes. Stating that Adam was created alone, he interprets the accounts of the creation of Adam in a way that helps to dispel modern innovations of interpretation, refuting those who imagine that an entire race was created at once, as some men may read Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, or that some other Adam was created after the creation of Adam, as some may read Genesis chapter 2, verse 19. Further, where wisdom is said to have brought Adam out of his fall, that does not mean that Adam was already somehow restored to his pre-fall state. It only states that Adam survived his fall and lived on through the wisdom of God. Now Solomon upholds the fact of Adam's dominion in spite of his fall. In verse 2 of Wisdom chapter 10, he says, "And gave him power," meaning Adam, "to rule all things," meaning Adam or man, as it is in the Greek text of Wisdom. But he's clearly referring to Adam. This is a reference to the commission given to Adam in Genesis chapter 1. And the way that Genesis chapter 1 was worded, the commission is given to the entire race of Adam, not merely to Adam, the individual, alone. We read in the King James Version from verse 26 of that chapter, "And God said, let us make man," the word being Adam, "in our image, after our likeness, and let them have," if we read Paul of Tarsus in Romans chapter 4, he explains that God mentions things as existing which don't already exist, but he mentions them as existing as if they did exist, because when he speaks the word, he's guaranteeing that those things will exist. So this doesn't really mean that Yahweh God created a plurality of Adam all at one time, although Genesis chapter 1:26, chapter 1, verse 26, certainly has a plurality of Adam in mind, that it will happen. So it refers to the race of Adam, even if the one individual was first created alone. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So creating the first man, which is described in Genesis chapter 2, Yahweh God had already planned the creation of the first woman and foresaw their propagation into a race of men. Therefore, we may imagine, as Solomon also professes here, that even in his fallen state, the Adamic man would still rise to dominion over the creation of God. But this leads us to once again mention that heresy that Yahweh God had somehow created two races of men called Adam, one on the sixth day and one on some supposed eighth day of creation. It is certainly not true. Solomon, who descended from that Adam of Genesis chapter 2, here claims to have the dominion given to Adam, the Adam of Genesis chapter 1, and it is clear that they both must be the same Adam. So Solomon did not interpret the Genesis account in the way that some heretics claim it should be interpreted today, and instead, they manufacture lies. There is no so-called eighth day creation. The eighth day of creation hasn't even arrived yet. Now in wisdom, we see a reference to Cain. But when the unrighteous went away, or withdrew from her, meaning from wisdom, in his anger, he perished also in the fury wherewith he murdered his brother. Even if Cain, through the circumstances of his birth, didn't deserve the wisdom of Yahweh God, he nevertheless grew up in it with his parents and his brother. The entire second clause comes from only three Greek words, where it says he perished also in the fury wherewith he murdered his brother. That comes from only three Greek words. Adelpho katanois is the dative form of a noun, of an adjective, meaning brother murderer. And then soon apoleto and thumois, which is in wrath. It's the dative form of thumos. The first word, a dative case form of the adjective, adelpho katanis, describes one who is murdering a brother or who is a brother murderer. The verb, a medium voice form of sum apolluni, indicates that the subject had destroyed himself or had perished together along with someone or something else. We would translate the clause to read, in murdering his brother, he himself was destroyed in his wrath. Or perhaps, in murdering his brother, he himself had perished in wrath. In other words, Cain may have been a bastard, upon which Solomon does not comment here. But after his sacrifice, he was rejected. And upon being challenged by God to do good, after his sacrifice was rejected, and upon being challenged by God to do good, he could not escape his anger, and he killed his brother, by which act he is described here as destroying himself in the process. As Christ had explained in the parable, Yahweh God has promised to destroy all of the goats. But in the end, if we examine that parable, they shall be judged unworthy of salvation for reason of how they had treated the sheep, even though they were never worthy of salvation. They were judged unworthy of salvation according to the way they acted, because a bastard can never do good in the eyes of God. So now Solomon makes another reference to Abel, and we read verse 4. For whose cause the earth, being drowned with the flood, wisdom again preserved it, and directed the course of the righteous in a piece of wood of small value. By saying for whose cause, it seems probable that Solomon was referring to Abel, at least on the surface, because Abel was the brother whom Cain had killed, the cause of the descendants of Seth would certainly also be the cause of Abel, as it would be through Seth, and then through Noah, after him, and ultimately through Christ, that the race would be preserved, and vengeance for the blood of Abel would ultimately be executed. However, in the sentences which precede, Abel is never a subject. He is only alluded to in the adjective which describes Cain as a brother murderer. So it seems much more probable that Cain, being the subject of the sentence which precedes this, is still the subject here where it says, for whose cause? But how can it be said that the flood of Noah had come on account of Cain? This may only be true if the Nephilim, or fallen ones, of Genesis chapter 6 were related to Cain, as Cain was evidently a son of one of the Nephilim, the serpent. The representative of the fallen angels, which were referred to as the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and represented by the serpent of Genesis chapter 3. So, it is very, very likely that Genesis chapter 6 is a manifestation of the enmity prophesied by Yahweh God himself and forewarned, actually, by Yahweh himself in Genesis chapter 3. The phrase, a piece of wood of small value, may have been rendered simply as a cheap piece of wood, which is a reference to the Ark of Noah, which had evidently taken Noah as many as 120 years to build. Noah was 500 years old when it was completed. The Ark of Noah took Noah as many as 120 years to build. So after he's done, it's considered a piece of wood of small value. That is the meaning of Genesis chapter 6, verse 3, where we read, and Yahweh said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years. In other words, after 120 years, Yahweh is going to destroy man in the flood. Then, after saying that, Yahweh began to warn Noah to build an ark and told him why he needed to build it. So while it may have been a monumental task for Noah, it was still only a cheap piece of wood compared to the plan of Yahweh for his creation. Now Solomon continues to move through Adamic history and choose certain examples from it as an illustration of the workings of the wisdom of God set in contrast with the wicked deeds of men. In verse 5, he says, or he wrote, moreover, the nations in their wicked conspiracy being confounded, she found out wisdom, found out the righteous, and preserved him blameless unto God, and kept him strong against his tender compassion toward his son. The book of Genesis is written in a very concise manner, and it's written in a concise way in order for us to derive lessons from it. Even though it was perhaps as many as 1,300 years between the time when the floodwaters subsided and the time when Abraham was called. It's still only a span of three chapters in Genesis. Or if you want to count Genesis chapter 9, four chapters. Genesis 9, Genesis 10, Genesis 11, the division of the nations, and then there's the call of Abraham. Everything else was basically sin, was those ancient nations all going off into paganism, departing from the God of their fathers, departing from the way of Noah. The nations to which he refers to here must be the nations of the descendants of the sons of Noah, described in Genesis chapter 10. Therefore, the conspiracy of the nations is that which is found in Genesis chapter 11. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, "Go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly," meaning to dry the brick in a kiln and to harden it. And they had brick for stone, and they had slime for mortar. And they said, "Go to, let us build a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." So the subsequent verses describe the response of Yahweh God. The subsequent verses in Genesis chapter 11 describe the response of Yahweh God to that conspiracy, whereby he did confound them and scatter them abroad. Now, that process took many centuries. If you observe in the genealogy of Abraham, the number of years it was in the Septuagint chronology from the end of the flood to the call of Abraham, it was close to 1,300 years. If we count from the subsiding of the waters of the flood to the life of Peleg, where it says in his life was the earth divided, that means that in the life of Peleg were the nations, the lands or regions that each of the nations of Genesis chapter 10 were divided during the life of Peleg. So that brings us to about 2500 BC. And it's still nearly 500 years to the call of Abraham. And that's a digression, which is not in my notes, but maybe I should have written it when I prepared these notes. I prepared these notes back on Tuesday, I think. Monday, I forget. I'm sorry, I prepared these notes last week before last week's open forum. The subsequent history, which is evident in the Old Testament, reveals that all of those nations had departed from the ways of their fathers and had gone off into what we call paganism, even the kindred of Abraham. For which reason, Paul of Tarsus had said, as it is written in Acts chapter 14, when certain Lycaonians had imagined that both he and Barnabas were gods, he said, "Sirs, why do you do these things? We also are men of like passions with you, and preach unto you that you should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth, and the sea, and all things that are therein, who in times past suffered all nations to walk in their own ways." These Lycaonians were not Israelites, but they were descendants of some of those Genesis 10 nations, most likely from the Japhethite tribes, or possibly from other Shemites. Out of a world which was entirely pagan, Abraham was called. Note that, as it says in Genesis chapter 11, in ancient Babel, The whole earth was of one language and of one speech, and is portrayed as conspiring against God. Today, once again, nearly all the world is of one language and speech as more and more aliens learn English and partake of the common worldwide culture, which is called pop or popular culture, or also mass culture. And that culture is spread by mass media, which compels all people to conform to particular beliefs and practices, and also encourages the spread of materialism and commercialism. In scripture, this is called Mystery Babylon, a word which is derived from the name of ancient Babel, and Yahweh God has also promised to confound it once again, as it is the rebirth of the original conspiracy which Solomon describes here. Man uniting himself where Yahweh God divided the nations, and man seeking to become as God, seeking to become his own God, which is humanism. It's the essence of humanism, which is Jewish in nature and spread through originally through the secret societies of Europe and the Freemasonic lodges. So Abraham was called, and wisdom kept him strong against his tender compassion toward his son, which describes his sacrifice of Isaac. Next, there is a reference to the preservation of Lot from the fires of Sodom and Gomorrah. When the ungodly perished, she delivered the righteous man who fled from the fire which fell down upon the five cities. And here, of course, the righteous man is Lot, who was saved from Sodom along with his daughters, and his wife was nearly saved with him. Sodom and Gomorrah were evidently the two most notable of the five cities of the plain, as they were referred to in Genesis chapters 13 and 19. I believe they are also referred to that way in ancient inscriptions uncovered at Ebla. So now the end of those cities is described, of whose wickedness, even to this day, the wasteland that smokes is a testimony, and plants bearing fruit that never come to ripeness, and a standing pillar of salt is a monument of an unbelieving soul, a reference to the wife of Lot. To this day, there are monuments in Palestine of ruins which look very much like buildings, and which must be buildings that were turned to ashes but by some unknown but magnificent flash of fire. For some extraordinary evidence of this, there is a documentary video archived at Christigenia, which was made by denominational Christians, titled Sodom and Gomorrah in Documentary. This existence of these building-like ruins, which are basically cinders, it should be upheld today as a monument against the corruption of today. This documentary, while we do not agree with the universalist theology, which is expressed in this presentation, the actual images and descriptions of findings at the site, which is believed to be a remnant of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain, are quite striking and quite undeniable. Some of the cities of the plain may lie under portions of what we call the Dead Sea. The ancient Greeks called that sea Lake Asphaltitis, for the asphalt which was harvested there. Asphalt is a substance very similar to tar. Today the Jews sell products such as salt or cosmetics made from materials harvested from the Dead Sea. And they sell these things in mall kiosks around the world throughout Mystery Babylon, whereby they are profiting from the remains of long-dead sodomites and inducing the world to consume them. If you spread Dead Sea cosmetics on your face, you're spreading the remains of ancient sodomites on your face. If you eat salt from the Dead Sea, you're eating minerals from the remains of ancient sodomites. That is a fitting reward for those who worship pop culture consumerism. So here we see that at least 800 years after the fact, if we accept that Solomon was the author of wisdom, that smoke was still rising from the ashes of Sodom and other cities of the plain. The unbelieving soul, Lot's own wife, had looked back when she was told not to look back. In doing so, she became a memorial for those who do not believe, meaning that her looking back was an act of disobedience resulting from a lack of belief. The lack of belief did not necessarily kill her, but the disobedience in which it resulted had killed her. It's not enough to just believe. One must believe and regulate his actions according to belief. Today's modern Christians, these denominational Christians, they profess to believe in Jesus, but they don't pay any attention to where he said, "Keep my commandments." So they accept modern sodomites. And they even defend their right to be sodomites. In Genesis chapter 19, we see the real effects of disbelief, because disbelief always leads to disobedience. And when the morning arose, when the angels hastened Lot, saying, "Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city." And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, and Yahweh being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him outside the city, or without city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, "Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee." Look not behind thee, real simple, four words. "Neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed." Then, a little later on, in spite of the demand that they do not look back as they fled the city, we read in verse 26, "But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt." Now, speaking of all those who had died in these judgments, for regarding not wisdom, they gat not only this hurt, that is archaic language. They received not only this hurt, perhaps, that they knew not the things which were good. So that is being described by Solomon as a hurt, as damage to one, that you regarded not wisdom, that you would not know what is good. You would never experience it if you don't follow the wisdom of God. And then he adds to that, "But also they left behind them to the world a memorial of their foolishness, so that in the things wherein they offended, they could not so much as be hid." Because when men see those monuments in the desert in Palestine, they should read the scripture. They should inquire into history as to what happened to those cities and learn from that. Now, the language of this passage is difficult, and the King James translation is archaic, so we would read verse 8 to read, "For bypassing wisdom, not only were they hurt, for that they knew not the goodly things, but also they left the foolishness in life for a memorial, that the things in which they had fallen, they were not even able to escape. Note that the people of the cities of the plain, as it is related here, had done harm to themselves. They did harm to themselves in their sin, not only from the results of their sin, but simply from not ever having experienced what is good in life. Now Sodom and Gomorrah, whose remains can be seen to this very day, stand as a memorial to the foolishness of their behavior. And those who partake in such things shall not escape the wrath of God. The Sodomites of today should have already taken notice, yet more and more supposedly Christian people are infected with and tolerate the disease. The fire will indeed rain down upon them, while they will evidently stay in denial up until the very time that the moment finally comes, and then it will be too late. These Sodomites of today are all going to die as a result of their sin, and they will also die never having experienced goodly things, not knowing what it is, how wonderful it is to marry a wife of your own race, to raise children of your own race, to be a man and stand up for your family and build a house for your family and do all the things that men should naturally want to do. All of these Sodomites today are missing out on the goodly things in life. So they're not going to take good lessons and the benefits of obedience to God with them to the life beyond. But now there is an expression of hope for those of us who do not partake of the folly, but wisdom delivered from pain those that attended upon her, those who were obedient to the instructions that the angels related from God. We would translate this verse to read, but wisdom delivered those consulting her from travails. That's much more literal and much more accurate. Consulting wisdom. One seeks to learn and to be obedient to the will of God, because wisdom is the word which comes from God. But even if the law was not yet given at the time of the destruction of the cities of the plain, men still had an opportunity to call upon God. As we see in Genesis chapter 4 in verse 26, and to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of Yahweh. And after a couple of generations, they forsook and forgot him. The experiences of the first fathers must have been transmitted to those subsequent generations. Not calling upon God, men often suffered the consequences of their actions. Now, sodomy has become prevalent in society once again, and at least many of the denominational Christians of today believe that sodomites shall not be punished because the law was somehow done away with in Christ, which is certainly not true. They should take heed from the warning that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed before the law of Sinai was even given. So what was evil without the written law in the days of Lot is still evil without the written law in these days. Sodomy could not be justified without the law then, and it cannot be justified now. Next, Solomon moves on in time to describe the plight of Jacob. When the righteous fled from his brother's wrath, she guided him in right paths, showed him the kingdom of God, and gave him knowledge of the holy things, which made him rich in his travels and multiplied the fruit of his labors. The word translated as travels here, makthas, is literally hardships. In the final clause, there is no word for fruit in the text, although it may be inferred. This is an account of the flight of Jacob to Paddan Aram, as not only was he sent there to find a wife, but he was also being sent away from his brother Esau, who had vowed to kill him. This is found in Genesis chapter 27. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then will I slay my brother Jacob." And these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah. And she sent and called to Jacob, her younger son, and said unto him, "Behold, thy brother Esau, as touching thee," meaning concerning thee, "does comfort himself, purposing to kill thee." Excuse me. "Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise. Flee thou." Now here the Septuagint adds the words "into Mesopotamia." "Flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran," the city from whence Abraham had come, "and tarry with him a few days until thy brother's fury turn away." Of course, Rebekah herself was also from Haran. "Tarry with him a few days," that was actually 20-something years, "until thy brother's fury turn away, until thy brother's anger turn away from thee, and he forgets that which thou hast done to him. Then I will send and fetch thee from thence. Why should I be deprived also of you both in one day?" Of you both. In other words, that if Esau killed his brother, he would also destroy himself, just like it was described of Cain here in the Wisdom of Solomon. In the verses which follow, Rebekah convinces Isaac as to why this is necessary, and Isaac sends Jacob to Paddan Aram, where, after much toil, he was blessed with wives and cattle. In the covetousness of such as oppressed him, she, meaning wisdom, stood by him, meaning Jacob, and made him rich. Obey the wisdom of God and follow him. It's not a guarantee to prosperity. Many men have obeyed the wisdom of God all their lives and died in poverty. However, it is certain that they built up treasure in heaven. In Paddan Aram, Laban, who was his own uncle, had sought to take advantage of Jacob and profit from him, even as he gave him his daughters to wife. So Laban deceived Jacob after 7 years' labor by giving him a daughter he did not want, and made him work seven more for the daughter that he wanted. But in spite of that, Yahweh enriched Jacob while he was with Laban, to the point where Laban and his sons, in their covetousness, began to despise him. Then we read in Genesis chapter, despise and envy him, I should say. Then we read in Genesis chapter 31, "And Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field unto his flock, and said unto them, I see your father's countenance, that he is not toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me." Remember that Abraham's ancestors were pagans. So Laban was a pagan, his sons were pagan, Rachel and Leah were pagans. "And ye know that with all my power I have served your father, and your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. wounds, but God suffered him not to hurt me. So Jacob departed Haran with his family and his goods. But he had other challenges to face on his journey, where, speaking of wisdom, Solomon now says, she defended him from his enemies and kept him safe from those that lie in wait. And in a sore conflict, she gave him the victory that he might know that goodness is stronger than all. The clause which reads, she gave him the victory, is literally only, she decided for him, meaning in his favor. The word translated as goodness here, Eusebia, Eusebia, is literally piety or reverence towards God. Returning to Canaan, after 20 years in Mesopotamia, and before he settled near Shechem, Jacob had his reunion with Esau, and contrary to his expectations, he was favored by him. Along the way, he also overcame the angel of God, which had wrestled with him. Some aspects of the Genesis account of that event are obscure, but it is evident that Jacob prevailed in both instances due to his own inherent goodness, and that is the lesson which Solomon conveys here. When men face adversity and opposition, godly righteousness is the best weapon which they may carry to the battle, even regardless of whether they win. So according to Solomon, that is a lesson which Jacob himself had learned in his struggles. Now he moves on to reflect upon the account of the patriarch Joseph. When the righteous was sold, she forsook him not, meaning wisdom forsook him not, but delivered him from sin. She went down with him into the pit. Now, by the wisdom of God, Joseph was preserved in spite of the sin of his brothers in the pit in which they had abandoned him. But later, he himself had also been kept from sinning when he was tempted by the wife of Potiphar, an officer of the Pharaoh. As Moses had written the account, somehow Joseph understood that adultery was a sin against God, while the wife of Potiphar accused him unjustly, causing him to be in prison. So for his righteousness, he was favored by God, and he was ultimately elevated over all Egypt by the Pharaoh himself, as we read in Wisdom chapter 1. For froward thoughts separate from God, and his power, when it is tried, reproves the unwise. For into a malicious soul wisdom shall not enter, the wife of Potiphar, nor dwell in the body that is subject unto sin. So Joseph, resisting sin, wisdom was with him. Now, speaking of wisdom in relation to Joseph, we read, and left him not in bonds, till she, meaning wisdom, brought him the scepter of the kingdom and power against those that oppressed him. As for them that had accused him, she showed them to be liars and gave him perpetual glory. The plural participle, translated as those that oppressed, is more literally those who tyrannized, those who tyrannized over him. Joseph, being released from his bonds, by the grace of God, was given authority over those who had unrighteously ruled over him, and their accusations against him came to naught. While written laws transmitted from Yahweh God himself were first given at Sinai, the concept of law was not born at Sinai. Kings of other nations had codified their own laws over the centuries before Moses. In Genesis chapter 26, where Yahweh God speaks to the patriarch Isaac, we read, "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and I will bless thee, For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swore unto thy father Abraham. And I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So the patriarchs must have kept an older tradition of moral laws, which was not recorded in Scripture, by which they sought to be pleasing in the eyes of God. Another example is found in Genesis chapters 7 and 8, where Noah had already known what animals were clean, meaning what animals could be eaten, and what animals were unclean. And he was commanded to preserve many more clean animals than unclean. Therefore, referring to the temptation of adultery, Joseph is described as having said in Genesis chapter 39, "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So the wisdom which accompanied Joseph to Egypt is twofold. First, he was preserved according to the providence of God. And then, Joseph maintained himself in a manner which pleases God, a manner which was only later put down in writing at Sinai. By this, we may perceive that while the moral laws were codified at Sinai, that is not where they were conceived. The laws themselves preceded the codification, so that they have always been law, so long as there has been a God, because the law itself is a product of the wisdom of God. So with or without the old covenant, as the lives of Jacob and Joseph both preceded the covenant at Sinai, the moral laws of God do not change, and Christ had referred to them as the commandments which men must keep. Therefore, fornication, sodomy, and adultery are sins yesterday, today, and forever. Now Solomon moves on to recount aspects of the Exodus from bondage in Egypt. She delivered the righteous people and blameless seed from the nation that oppressed them, even though the children of Israel in the Exodus were stiff-necked and had reverted to the idolatry of paganism at every opportunity. Solomon nevertheless refers to them as the righteous people and blameless seed. And that is an indication that righteousness is not reckoned by God according to the manner of men. The word translated as righteous here also reflects that assessment, as Hoseas, which is translated as righteous here. Hoseas is defined by Liddell and Scott to mean hallowed, sanctioned by the law of God, opposed to dikaios, which is sanctioned by human law. So we continue with verse 16. She entered into the soul of the servant of the Lord, and withstood dreadful kings in wonders and signs. The servant of Yahweh is, of course, Moses, and describes how he stood up against Pharaoh and pronounced the plagues which were to come upon Egypt, things which are described in Exodus chapters 8 and 9. So we will read the first of those pronouncements. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, "Go unto Pharaoh, and say unto him, Thus saith Yahweh, Let my people go, that they may serve me. And if thou refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all thy borders with frogs, and the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thy house, and into thy bedchamber, and upon thy bed, and into the house of thy servants, and upon thy people, and into thine ovens, and into thy kneading troughs. And the frog shall come up both on thee, and upon thy people, and upon all thy servants. It seems quite surreal that Moses could have stood before a mighty king, the Pharaoh, and pronounced those curses upon him if his demands were not met. And this Moses was compelled to do by Yahweh God many times. The wisdom of men would say, there's no way I'm going before Pharaoh and telling him that he's going to have frogs in his bed. But the wisdom of God compelled Moses to do that, in spite of how crazy it might sound in the eyes of men, or in the ears of men. Only by the wisdom of God could Moses have had the courage to do such a thing and prevail. What are you, nuts? I'm not going to tell the king that. That's just crazy. He's just going to shoot me. Well, Moses did it, and he survived, and he prevailed, in spite of what men may think is rational. Continuing to describe the Exodus, Solomon next professes that wisdom had rendered to the righteous a reward of their labors, guided them in a marvelous way, and was unto them for a cover by day and a light of stars in the night season. And the word season in the translation is not in the text, but here it is inferred as a colloquial expression for the time of night, a light of stars in the nighttime. The archaic language of the King James Version, evident once again. And once again, where it is in the plural in Greek and refers to the people of God, the word righteous is translated from the Greek word hosios, used as a substantive, which is a word that is not regularly a noun, being used as a noun. So it describes a people who are hallowed or sanctioned by the law of God. It may have been rendered as saints here, and that is also the true biblical definition of a saint, one of the people sanctioned by the law of God. If you're not sanctioned by the law of God, you can't be a saint. Not all people are sanctioned by the law of God. Thus we read in Leviticus chapter 20, and ye shall be holy unto me, for I, Yahweh, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that you should be mine. This command to be holy has never gone away. It was reported by the apostles of Christ and demanded that, speaking of their intended audiences, you be holy as Yahweh is holy. Once again, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, we read from verse 6, for thou art a holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God has chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. Where it says that wisdom had guided them in a marvelous way and was unto them for a cover by day and a light of stars in the night season, it must be a reference to the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, which led the children of Israel by night and day in their journey out of Egypt. The righteous reward, which is mentioned here, is a reference to the gold of Egypt taken by the children of Israel as they departed in the Exodus. Thus we read from Exodus chapter 11, and Yahweh said unto Moses, yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go hence. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out hence altogether. Speak now in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor, and every woman of her neighbor. Now, there's interesting constructions there, because men have male neighbors, and women have female neighbors. Your wife should have male neighbors in that sense, unless she's with you. And every woman of her neighbor, jewels of silver and jewels of gold. And Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. Then in chapter 12 of Exodus, after all of the firstborn of Egypt were smitten, and the children of Israel did according to the word of Moses, and they borrowed of the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment. And Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them such things as they required, and they spoiled the Egyptians. Continuing to speak in reference to the Exodus, Solomon now says in wisdom, brought them through the Red Sea, and led them through much water. But she drowned their enemies and cast them up out of the bottom of the deep. In Exodus chapter 15, after the children of Israel had crossed through the parting of the Red Sea, we read, and the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch, Yahweh looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians. Yahweh, God given human attributes here. This makes it evident that the waters did not return suddenly, but where it refers to the morning watch, that is the approach of the break of day the following morning. Now continuing with the account from Exodus 15. And took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily. The horses would have a hard time dragging chariots without wheels. So that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for Yahweh fights for them against the Egyptians. And Yahweh said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its strength when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled against it, and Yahweh overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned, and covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus Yahweh saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians' bed upon the seashore. And Israel saw that the great work which Yahweh did upon the Egyptians. And the people feared Yahweh and believed Yahweh and his servant Moses. So where it says that Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore, that is why Solomon had written here that wisdom had cast them up out of the bottom of the deep. Now Solomon affirms our interpretation of verse 17 and the reward which the righteous took from the Egyptians as they departed, where he says in verse 20, therefore the righteous spoil the ungodly, and praise thy holy name, O Yahweh, and magnify with one accord thine hand that fought for them. Here, addressing Yahweh directly, we see that Solomon has been praying all along, and that will be evident throughout the rest of this book. But as for what he had said here, the righteous spoiling the ungodly, ultimately, Yahweh God has made all things, And he will deliver those things into the custody of whomever he chooses, apart from the justice of men. This same lesson is expressed in the 24th Psalm, a psalm attributed to David, and we shall read the opening verses. The earth is Yahweh's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwelt therein. For he has founded it upon the seas, and established it upon the floods, upon the rivers. Who shall ascend into the hill of Yahweh? Or who shall stand in his holy place? He that has clean hands, David answering his own questions. He that has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive the blessing from Yahweh and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is the generation or race of them that seek him, that seek thy face, O Yahweh. Yet Solomon had written in Proverbs chapter 16, better it is to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. Of course, the words of Solomon are true in that regard. But when men have material possessions, it is because Yahweh God wants them to have such things so that his purpose may be accomplished. That is evident in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, that he might prove to thee, to do thee good at thy later end? So when we're given wealth, it's for the purpose of God. And when we're humble, it's for the purpose of God. If we rebel against our humble state, or if we spoil our wealth with frivolous things, then in either way, we're rebelling against God. We should accept what he gives to us as being for his purposes and work with what he gives us to please him. And now say in thy heart, Deuteronomy 8:17, my power and the might of mine hand has gotten me this wealth when they're lifted up from their poverty. But thou shalt remember Yahweh thy God, for it is he that gives thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore unto thy fathers, as it is this day. So when men are deprived of such things, it is because Yahweh wants them to be deprived for his purposes. That demonstrates the folly of covetousness. When we covet our neighbor's goods, we are jealous of how God has blessed our neighbor. So we are sinning against God. If we went back to that lesson of Laban and his sons being envious of Jacob, and I didn't read that part of the text, but if we go back to that and read the entire chapter, we'll see that Laban knew that Jacob's blessings were from Yahweh God, and nevertheless coveted and was envious of Jacob, in spite of knowing that it came from God. That's basically, while it's not direct rebellion against God, it's nevertheless rebelling against God. For that reason, in chapter 10 of his epistle to the Hebrews, Paul wrote of the Babylonian captivity of Israel, and he said, now remember the former days in which, being enlightened, you endured a great struggle of sufferings. On the one hand, being made a spectacle with both reproaches and afflictions, and on the other, having become partners of those so returning, for you also sympathize with the prisoners, those who were taken into captivity, and you accepted the seizure of your possessions with joy, knowing to have and awaiting a better possession yourselves, because even if we lose everything we have, we nevertheless have the promises of God. So we have to continue in obedience to him, knowing, to have, and awaiting a better possession. And Paul is using the circumstances of the Babylonian captivity as an example of that to the Hebrews in that chapter of his epistle. Ultimately, the meek shall inherit the earth, and therefore Yahweh had promised the children of Israel in their captivity in Isaiah chapter 60 that whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, so that no man went through thee, I will make thee an eternal excellency, a joy of many generations. Thou shalt also suck the milk of the nations, and shalt suck the breast of kings, and thou shalt know that I, Yahweh, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. For brass I will bring gold, and for iron I will bring silver, and for wood brass, and for stones iron. I will also make thy officers peace, and thine exactors righteousness. Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders. But thou shalt call thy walls salvation, and thy gates praise. And of course, at that time, they didn't even have cities. But Yahweh was telling the captivity of the children of Israel that they would have the possessions of the other nations. Now, in the final verse of Wisdom chapter 10, for wisdom opened the mouth of the dumb and made the tongues of them that cannot speak eloquent. Made eloquent the tongues of them that cannot speak, may have been a little better. The mouth of the dumb is evidently a reference to the ass of Balaam, whom the angel of Yahweh had apparently made to appear as if speaking in Numbers chapter 22. That's a little redundant, the way I wrote that. But where it says that wisdom made the tongues of them that cannot speak eloquent, we would translate the phrase more literally to read that the tongues of infants she made eloquent. This evokes the words of the 8th Psalm attributed to David, where it says, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. But in the gospel, as it is recorded in Matthew chapter 21, Christ cited that psalm in the manner in which it appears in the Septuagint, where the crowd at the gate upon his triumphant entrance into Jerusalem were extolling Christ, and men who were offended by that had addressed him and said unto him, hearest thou what these say? And Jesus said unto them, yeah, have you never read, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou perfected praise? The reference to infants is therefore an allegory for the unlearned majority of people among men. But perhaps by saying that, here, for wisdom opened the mouth of the dumb and made the tongues of them that cannot speak eloquent, Solomon may also have been referring to Moses himself, as we read in Exodus chapter 4. And Moses said unto Yahweh, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. So then we read the response. And Yahweh said unto him, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, Yahweh? Here an important element of the wisdom of Solomon may be realized, which is the fact that every turn of men and nations is determined and guided by the wisdom of God. This is not to say that the rulers and the people have that wisdom, or that they even need to have it in order to accomplish the will of God. But rather, Yahweh God imparts to whomsoever he will either wisdom or blindness, which leads to folly, in order to accomplish his will in the earth. Solomon's prayer is a sign of his own humility, that he recognized that true wisdom could only come from God, that any wisdom of man shall fail to stand against the wisdom of God, and therefore it is the wisdom of God which he desired. Rather than relying on his own mind and heart, he had sought what it is that Yahweh God desires. Neither is there any value in the words of ancient sages and philosophers who did not know Yahweh God and whom Solomon did not seek. Another recurring theme, as Solomon describes the events of the past in this manner, is that men should learn from these lessons of history within that context, within that same context, as its lessons are only lessons when one seeks understanding from the wisdom of God. When you see these things through the lens of the laws and commandments of God in the scriptures, only then do they become lessons. When you're a mental reprobate, when you're a sodomite or an adulterer, you might look back at Sodom and Gomorrah or what happens in the punishments of similar sins, and you might think, God is mean. God is an asshole. God is cruel and tortures people for no reason. Where, in fact, you must repent of your sin and conform your mind to God, and then you'll understand why he punished those people. It's that simple. It's either black or white. There's no in between. When we commence with Wisdom chapter 11, Solomon continues to reflect upon the many wonderful things which befell the ancient children of Israel on account of the wisdom of God. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.